Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Stanford historians James Sheehan and David Kennedy for the Cold War and its legacies, exploring the global impact of this pivotal era. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. The Trump administration has paused all asylum immigration decisions affecting more than a million people following the shooting of two National Guard members, allegedly by an Afghan asylum recipient. Just the latest in a series of escalating immigration restrictions that, according to experts, now target both undocumented immigrants and people who have entered the U.S. legally. We'll check in with our local Afghan community and talk about what these sweeping changes mean for legal immigrants, asylum seekers, and the federal agencies carrying out deportations. It's all coming up next, right after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Shay Stevens. The U.S. Supreme Court has cleared the way for Texas to use its newly redrawn congressional map in the 2026 midterm elections. As NPR's Hansi Wong reports, the decision boosts the Republican Party's chances of keeping control of the House of Representatives.
This final Supreme Court decision means that next year's midterm election in Texas will be held using a congressional map that could help Republicans pick up five more House seats. The ruling comes after President Trump pushed Texas and other Republican-led states to draw new voting districts to help the GOP win. A lower court blocked Texas's redrawn map after finding its challengers are likely to prove in a trial that the map violates the Constitution by discriminating against voters based on their race. That's because multiple top Republican lawmakers made public statements suggesting they passed it to get rid of existing districts where Black and Latino voters together make up the majority. The congressional gerrymandering fight now continues in other states. A federal court hearing on California's new map is set for this month. Anzi Luong, NPR News.
The U.S. military has struck yet another small boat in the eastern Pacific Ocean, killing four people. That attack came amid a briefing on another strike in the Caribbean. As NPR's Sam Greenglass reports, congressional lawmakers have seen a video of the September strike that killed survivors aboard an alleged drug boat off Venezuela.
The video was shown to the top Republicans and Democrats on the Intelligence and Armed Services Committees. Representative Jim Himes, the ranking Democrat on the Intelligence Committee, said the video of the strike showed two individuals on a largely destroyed vessel, which he says violates the laws of armed conflict.
What I saw in that room was one of the most troubling things I've seen in my time in public service.
Senate Intelligence Committee Chair Republican Tom Cotton said he did not believe the second strike was illegal.
I didn't see anything disturbing about it. What's disturbing to me is that millions of Americans have died from drugs being run to America by these cartels.
President Trump told reporters he would be willing to release video of the strike. Sam Greenglass, NPR News, Washington.
Meta is expected to cut up to 30% of the workers in its Metaverse unit. As NPR's Bobby Allen reports, the tech giant is spending heavily on artificial intelligence.
When Facebook changed its name to Meta in 2021, CEO Mark Zuckerberg said it was a way to reframe the company's ambitions in what's known as the metaverse. But that reality never came to pass, even if the name change stuck. Now, as the AI boom continues, Meta executives are set to slash staff on its virtual reality product, Meta Horizon Worlds, and its Quest VR headset. A Meta official confirmed the expected cuts to NPR after Bloomberg first reported it. Zuckerberg said in a social media post that Meta will be putting new energy into developing AI glasses. Meta also has committed to spending tens of billions of dollars on new AI data centers, despite concerns that Silicon Valley is overbuilding AI infrastructure. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
U.S. futures are flat and after-hours trading on Wall Street. This is NPR. The Justice Department has failed to get a new indictment against New York Attorney General Letitia James, citing alleged mortgage fraud. DOJ returned to a grand jury in Virginia after a judge dismissed previous charges against James and former FBI Director James Comey. Both cases were deemed failed indictments because the prosecutor who filed them was illegally appointed. The murder of UnitedHealthcare CEO a year ago has put a spotlight on frustrations over the high cost of U.S. healthcare. NPR's Maria Aspen has more.
The costs of healthcare are set to skyrocket next year for tens of millions of people on Obamacare. They're also going up for the many more who get health insurance through their employers. Now the companies and investors who profit from this business are also struggling financially. Shares in United Health Group, the massive for-profit company that owns United Healthcare, have plunged 45% in the past year. Catherine Hempstead is a policy officer at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
I think right now we're really going off the rails and we're having, you know, lots and lots of problems in every segment of the business.
As she points out, if even the people making money from this healthcare system aren't happy with it, how sick is it? Maria Aspen, NPR News, New York.
And New Zealand police have recovered a limited edition Fabergé pendant that had been stolen from a jewelry store in Auckland last week. The suspect was arrested minutes after the theft inside the store but swallowed the jewelry. He was kept in police custody until the item could be retrieved naturally. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
This week at KQED.org, Bay Area electricity bills are some of the highest, but where does that money go? Reporter Laura Clivens breaks down the charges on one bill. That's at KQED.org. The Weather Service has posted a coastal flood advisory for king tides through Sunday. Fog will blanket the inland valleys tonight in Northern California. Lows will be in the 40s. This is KQED News.
Welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Regular Forum listeners and just about everyone who lives on the southern side of the East Bay knows that there's a large Afghan and African-American community centered in the city of Fremont. Over the decades that global powers have tussled over their country of origin, many people from that part of the world have come to the U.S. through a variety of programs, and an estimated 60,000 have settled around here. Obviously, with the chaotic U.S. withdrawal from the country, the community has experienced a lot of difficulty and strain over the last several years, and now the Trump administration's new stance targeting Afghan asylees and immigrants is threatening the community's newest members and overall status. Here to discuss the situation, we're joined by Joseph Azam, who's board chair of the Afghan American Foundation, a nonpartisan nonprofit focused on advocating on behalf of the Afghan American community. Welcome, Joseph.
Thanks for having me, Alexis.
We're also joined by Karen Musallo, who's professor of law and director of the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies at UC Law San Francisco. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
And we have Nick Miroff, staff writer covering immigration, the Department of Homeland Security, and the U.S.-Mexico border for The Atlantic. Thanks for joining us, Nick.
Thanks, Alexis. Good to be with you again.
So, Joseph, let's start with you. Maybe you can just walk us through what the last, you know, week, 10 days have been like for you as a leader in the Afghan community.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, what it's been like for me and for our community it's been scary. Mm-hmm. It's been incredibly sad. I mean, what happened in D.C., the murder was a heinous crime. And just as people, it's been devastating to see that happen in our country. And it's been incredibly unsettling to see the response from our government. Mm.
What are you actually hearing from the folks that you serve? Like, what are people's kind of core concerns?
I mean, the core concern is that, I mean, what we're seeing is collective punishment and collective culpability for one person's really heinous act. Mm-hmm. At its core, that is what people are talking about.
Yeah. And what do people fear that punishment might look like?
It's a great question. I think for Afghans who are here legally but don't have permanent status, they fear that that punishment and that retribution can come in the form of losing that legal status and potentially being sent back to, you know, certain death in Afghanistan. For the Afghan American community, who's been here for generations, it's a bit of a revisit to darker times in our country, right? Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of the post 9/11 period in particular, where we were scrutinized and scapegoated and subjected to a lot of hatred and bigotry, which really has had lasting impact on our community.
Yeah. Nick, let's come to you. For people who haven't been paying as close attention to what's happened in the aftermath of this shooting in D.C., what are the sort of policies that the Trump administration has announced since then?
Well, gosh, you know, there's a suspension of asylum adjudications. There's a kind of broad pause on some, you know, categories of, you know, green card processing, even some naturalization ceremonies. There's a travel ban on 19 nations that DHS is looking to expand to more than 30. I'm probably leaving some off, but, you know, it's a whole raft of new measures and policies that are looking more at the, you know, aspects of the legal immigration system and part of an effort to get, you know, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, you know, which administers the country's legal immigration system, as well as the State Department, kind of more involved in advancing the broader, you know, mass deportation campaign that the administration is carrying out.
Hmm. You, Karen, the thing I feel like we always find ourselves asking in these situations is this legal? Like, I thought asylum was the ability to ask for asylum was a right. Like, how does this, what's the legal justification that's being used and how do you see it?
Well, I think that's an excellent place to start is talking about the rule of law. And Congress in 1980 passed the Refugee Act, which provides that any person who arrives at our border or is within the U.S. has the right to seek asylum. And so when we see this administration putting an indefinite pause on adjudicating asylum applications, I think the question that has to be asked is exactly what you asked, Alexis, which is this legal? And we've seen, you know, many policies of the Trump administration challenged in court. And, you know, with many victories in the district courts and the courts of appeal. And I don't want to predict what's going to happen, but let's say I would not be surprised if this policy about pausing asylum adjudications and many other policies that were part of this most recent intensification of anti-immigrant, anti-refugee policies, as you know, I would expect to see these legal challenges continue.
What happens for someone who's sort of already in the process now, Karen?
Well, I think this is devastating for people. I think we have to put this within a context of people who are seeking asylum are people who have fled, either suffered already egregious persecution in their home countries or fear being persecuted. They're often arrived to the U.S. traumatized, frightened. They've come forward to seek protection under U.S. laws, following the laws by doing so. And now everything, you know, that they had hoped for to find some security and stability has been paused. And I think, as Joseph said, I want to echo this. This is very frightening for people. What does this really indicate about who this administration has chosen to go after and how this administration has used, you know, the tragic, you know, acts in D.C., the heinous crime of, you know, but committed by one person who happened to be Afghan, has used this to target every single, you know, immigrant in the U.S. who's seeking protection.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I can't help but saying that this doesn't seem like a rational response to this tragedy, mm-hmm. but rather an opportunistic use of this tragedy to do what this administration has shown from day one that it has wanted to do.
Joseph, let's talk a little bit about Operation Allies Welcome. This is the program that the alleged shooter came through. These are people who worked with, right, the CIA, the military, other U.S. government agencies in Afghanistan during our long war there. What did those people go through to get to the U.S.? Like, tell us a little bit about, like, who this particular set of people might be.
Sure. Well, in short, they went through a lot, including a significant amount of vetting. But beyond that, I mean, you know, the reason they left is because the Taliban had put targets on their backs and the backs of their family members because of their affiliation with the U.S. You know, for 20 years, most Afghans stood with America in a joint mission to take on the Taliban and terrorism. And when the country collapsed, the people who were most at risk were the ones who were closest to the U.S. And most of the people who got out immediately and were evacuated by our government were affiliated with the U.S. So they were translators, interpreters, civil society leaders who fought for democracy and women's rights, for example. These are the people who we eventually worked so hard, you know, across the political spectrum, across American society to get out after the collapse.
You know, Nick, that's the sort of most specific case here. The most general is all asylum decisions, right, which are now all paused. And we're talking over 1 million people whose lives are be affected by this.
Sure. I mean, this is like a continuation of the administration's shutdown along the border of, you know, of asylum processing when Trump took office. You know, the U.S. Customs and Border Protection is basically not, you know, allowing asylum seekers, you know, to get processed and released in, you know, in the way that we've seen over the past few years. And so now this is a, you know, extending more broadly across the country to people who are in some stage of the process who have pending claims, and it's going to, you know, throw this process into chaos.
Yeah. Right. There's another just term that I want people to hear, Nick. Maybe you could explain it. You know, some folks who came from Afghanistan had special immigrant visas. What was that program and how did it work?
So there were special immigrant visas, and then there were people who were paroled into the country. And that was basically an emergency measure used by the Biden administration to get, you know, people who were being evacuated from Afghanistan. You know, listeners will remember the images of people packed into the military cargo planes. Those planes didn't fly directly from Afghanistan to the United States. They were taken to third countries. And there was a rapid effort to conduct some level of vetting and then to give people, you know, pathways into the United States legally, so that they could arrive here, they could be safe, they could, and then they could be, you know, processed, you know, slowly and to apply for proper, you know, asylum status. And that's the status that many of these, you know, tens of thousands of people are still in who are going to be affected by these edicts.
Yeah. You know, the Trump administration has said the reason for this is because they feel the vetting under the Biden administration wasn't adequate. What do we know about the process that was used and what may or may not have changed in this new administration?
Well, you know, there was vetting that occurred even as part of, as I said, you know, the parole process and through special immigrant visas. And then there's additional vetting that is supposed to occur, you know, here in the United States. It should be noted that that the shooter, his asylum application was approved in April, you know, by the Trump administration. And so there are, you know, background checks. And in the case of an individual like the shooter who had worked with the CIA, you know, that type of person has probably, you know, gone through additional rounds of screening and vetting. So to claim that this is a vetting failure that occurred only during the Biden presidency doesn't seem to match the facts.
Yeah. We're talking about our country's immigration policies, especially in light of President Trump's decision to freeze asylum applications indefinitely. We're joined by The Atlantic's Nick Miroff. We've got UC Law San Francisco's Karen Musallo, who's professor of law and director of the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies. And of course, we've got Joseph Azam, a board chair of the Afghan American Foundation and someone who's joined us several times in the past. We want to hear from you. What are your questions about the changes to this asylum policy or other new immigration policies? What do you think about President Trump's decision to freeze these applications? The number is 866-733-6786, forum@kqed.org. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned.
Support for KQED comes from Mark Feringer's Nutcracker Suites at the Cowell Theater, a magical 50-minute danced storytelling with live music for children of all ages, December 6th through 21st in San Francisco. Tickets at fortmason.org. And from the University of San Francisco's MFA, offering the Bay Area's oldest writing program with small evening classes and one-on-one thesis mentoring, applications are open, usfca.mfa.edu. Coming up at 9 o'clock in the second hour of Forum, Guy Maserati is the guest host. We're going to discuss the negotiations over Affordable Care Act subsidies on Capitol Hill and how the issue of health care could shape the 2026 midterms. The second hour of Forum starts at 9 here on KQED San Francisco and KQEI North Highlands.
Welcome back to Forum. Alexis Madrigal here. We're talking about our country's immigration policies in light of some of the sweeping changes that President Trump has introduced since he took office, and most recently in the last 10 days when he decided to freeze asylum applications indefinitely. We're joined by Joseph Azam, board chair of the African American Foundation. It's a nonpartisan nonprofit that advocates on behalf of the African American community. We've got Nick Miroff, a staff writer covering immigration for The Atlantic. And we've got Karen Musallo, who is a professor of law and director of the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies at UC Law San Francisco. And of course, we're taking your calls about how these changes to asylum policy may affect you, family members, members of your community, and we'd love to hear from you. 866-733-6786, forum at kqed.org, and of course we're on all the social media things as well as KQED Forum. Let's bring in longtime Forum community member, at least, Hamayat in Fremont. Welcome.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to talk about something real quick. My family moved here from Afghanistan in the late 90s, and when we were there during the first Taliban regime, my dad was a doctor, and we could barely make it by every month, so it was very difficult. And now the stories I'm hearing from back home, it has gotten even worse for people. Economically, people don't have enough to eat every day or pay for their rent, so this seems like a very disheartening thing to happen at this moment. That's all I wanted to share. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Maya, thanks for listening, as always. Joseph, I mean, let's take this one to you, because of course there is this relationship that people have with Afghanistan here in the U.S., and it must be really troubling for people in the Afghan American community to know that the situation's deteriorating at home and there isn't the possibility now that people might be able to get out to come join them in the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Family reunification continues to be a big challenge for our community, particularly because some of the folks left behind are still in real danger. And beyond that, I mean, I think, you know, we see how successful the Afghans who have come here have been, right? And certainly they're more than their economic contributions. But they're making that, right? I think within their first year of work, this population contributed $1.4 billion to the U.S. economy. They paid almost $200 million in taxes, right? And over 80% of them really feel welcome here. So that's what is happening in the U.S. And to know that other people could have that opportunity in life and are being blocked from that has been incredibly painful and frustrating.
Yeah. You know, I want to return to this vetting topic as well, just because I think it might be helpful for people in our audience who are thinking, like, what is vetting? Like, we use this word, but like, for someone who's going through it, or if you've helped people go through it, like, what does it actually look like?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's important for Americans to understand, for Afghans in particular, what this meant. What it meant was biometric screening, biographic checks, security checks across intelligence agencies, fingerprinting, iris scans, facial photos, checking terror databases. We're talking about the DHS, the FBI, and the intelligence community all being involved. That is extensive vetting. And I would argue that, you know, we know more about these Afghans than we do most other Americans, right? So in every way possible, they are not strangers. They're people that we know really well and have taken a very hard look at.
Yeah. You know, Nick, I want to zoom out a tiny bit here. I mean, you've been covering this administration on immigration since day one. Fit this kind of latest policy maneuvers into the overarching stance that the Trump administration has taken. You know, Karen earlier mentioned she thought this was sort of an opportunistic move to do what the administration already wanted to be doing.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I've been an observer of Stephen Miller's for a long time now. He's obviously the architect of the president's immigration plans and his top domestic policy advisor. And one thing that's you know, been pretty consistent about his career is that whenever there is an opportunity that he can seize on to advance his broader agenda, he will take it. And what we saw last week between the, you know, the shooting in Washington and the fraud prosecution in Minnesota of members of the Somali immigrant community was, I think, the administration recognizing, you know, two political opportunities and trying to push them to the maximum. And it's expanding the administration's campaign, you know, to really the legal immigration system, really looking at people who are already here. You know, it's no longer just a security argument that the administration is making about the quote unquote worst of the worst. This is an opportunity to question, the admission of immigrants more broadly, of asylum seekers and refugees, and to depict them as, you know, parasitic, people who are coming here to take advantage of the country. And that's why you see the president, you know, making some the kind of, you know, xenophobic remarks that we saw when he said, you know, Somali immigrants were garbage. But this seems to be the new direction that they want to go in their broader deportation campaign.
Mm. Karen, what do you think?
Well, I agree with what's been said is this is an effort to use to turn tragedy into an opportunity, as I said earlier, to do what this administration has wanted to do. And I think I would be remiss if I didn't point out that so much of these policies of the Trump administration are based on a totally false narrative. They're based on lies, to be a little bit less polite. If we just take the vetting issue, you know, refugees are the most highly vetted population group that enters the U.S. There was a study that the Cato Institute did for looking at a 42-year period and looking at terrorist acts committed by refugees. And they said the likelihood that an American would be killed by a refugee was 1 in 3.86 billion. Mm-hmm. And so what that indicates is this is a highly vetted community. What happened in D.C. was the act of one individual who, you know, reportedly had been suffering very extreme mental health problems such that his caseworkers had expressed real concern, you know, and had asked for help. And so I think this isn't an issue of vetting. This is an issue of an individual who came to the U.S., who was traumatized, who had mental health problems, and who, this isn't to excuse what he did, but it's also to shift this narrative a little bit about this isn't about insufficient vetting. This is, and just to say this is similar to other narratives. Joseph talked about the incredible economic contributions that the Afghan community has made. And if we look at this just more broadly, every single economic study that's out there talks about immigrants, contributing a higher economic benefit than any services that they receive. So again, this narrative of immigrants being parasites living off society is incorrect. So I don't want to go on at length, but I will say that, you know, the Pope Leo, who is an American, came out, you know, within this last month, asking people of faith to reject the narrative that dehumanizes immigrants. And I would just add to that to reject the false narrative, because if we really look more deeply at the truth about the individuals, you know, immigrant community, what has been said about them is, you know, demonstrably false.
Yeah. And it also, you know, in a place like the Bay Area that has such a large percentage of the population having, you know, roots somewhere else, at least in part, you know, we're talking 30, 40, 50% of the population here. You know, what I wanted to talk about next, Nick, is there has been some, obviously a lot of the rhetoric that the Trump administration uses about immigrants has been a little bit unprecedented, at least in modern times. And one of the most disturbing things that I've seen is the Department of Homeland Security, in its sort of campaign to talk about self-deportation, use this term remigration. The president himself, I don't think, has said it yet. He said reverse migration, but remigration set off a lot of alarm bells for people who study the European far right. Why is that?
Well, that term remigration is associated with the European far right. And I don't, you know, see much of a distinction between the president saying reverse migration and remigration, even if those terms may mean slightly different things. It's the same general concept, and it's the idea that immigrants should leave. And I think it's worth noting what a radical step this is, and what a break this is from the Republican Party of the past, and you know the Reagan vision of the United States as a city on the hill, you know, welcoming and assimilating people. Stephen Miller himself had this very telling tweet, you know, after the shooting, the tragic shooting in Washington, that was to the effect of, you know, immigrants come and bring their problems, the problems of their, you know, quote unquote failed societies here. And then they basically become a drag on the United States, and they create new failures in the United States. That idea, you know, the idea that rather than immigrants coming and being assimilated, being, you know, becoming American, enriching the country, you know, finding opportunities here and growing the United States, this is a much darker vision. And to them, you know, remigration or reverse migration is really just a way of saying, you know, as the president did, you know, they should go home or go back to where you came from.
I mean, what do you think the theory is in this sort of Stephen Miller verse? You know, I can imagine some listeners, like Greg would say this. I think what the current administration is setting is a dangerous and radical precedent. It is illogical to assume that any and every person seeking asylum from 19 different countries is a possible terror threat. It's a total knee-jerk racist reaction to a serious issue. What do you think is going on or what has Stephen Miller said about, like, this is why we want to do this?
I think the White House knows that there's a lot of economic anxiety out there in the country. They're very worried about losing control of Congress, and they intend to scapegoat immigrants. I think it's as simple as that. Mm-hmm. They view immigration as one of the president's, you know, still, you know, better polling issues. They know that their base is thrilled by imagery of, you know, of immigration enforcement arrests and deportations. And they want to now blame some of the affordability concerns that the Democrats are trying to seize on, and turn them into kind of an immigration issue. And that's why you see Vice President Vance tweeting about, you know, rents falling in different U.S. cities and claiming that it's the result of the mass deportation campaign.
Hmm. Joseph, one of our listeners, Steve, writes, the issue with the Afghan asylee in D.C. seems to have less to do with his Afghan identity and more to do with serious PTSD issues. Bringing people from war-torn countries can be very problematic if we don't recognize the mental health challenges these people have and the need to address them. We've seen this with our own service members coming back from war that have been left to deal with these issues, leading to suicide and substance abuse. We failed them, and it looks like we're failing others involved in the war. As in Afghan American community in this area, what are the kind of supports that you've tried to build for people as they come here into this community?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say I can answer it in three ways. One, first and foremost, it's psychological safety. If people know that they've reached home, which this is for them, that goes a long way, right, in quieting their minds. Second is economic safety. We focused a lot on getting people into work. A lot of leading American companies actually have been specifically hiring Afghans, particularly those who've served alongside U.S. forces, because they're a well-trained, English proficient population. And third really is to weave them into the history that this country has had of welcoming people who fought for freedom, right? I'm thinking of Cubans who fled Castro, Hungarians that fled communists, and Jews that fled the Nazis. Like, we have a history in this country of embracing people who have fought for freedom and who needed safety. And for Afghans to feel a part of that history would really go a long way in getting them to feel comfortable here and focused on the future.
Yeah. Let's try Nadine in San Anselmo. Nadine, you're on. Welcome.
Hi. I just have a brief point to make. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, sure can.
Okay. Well, you know, at the beginning, the speaker said that the people are so upset about the punishing of the whole groups for the action of one. And I just wanted to say that if we were to go by that standard that the Trump regime is going by, we would probably punish all white males between the ages of 18 and 35 because statistically, those are the ones that have committed most of the mass shootings in this country. But no one ever thinks of penalizing all the white males between 18 and 35, because that wouldn't be fair. Mm-hmm. So that's just a little point I want to bring up.
Yeah.
Other points are that, of course, I was so aware of the Afghans who the country was turning its back on, in a sense, and probably not helping enough get out, who had been supportive of the democracy, women's rights, and the military. And thirdly, you know, grandparents came here from Russia fleeing pogroms. So it's very personal.
Yeah.
Thank you, Nadine.
Yeah, I appreciate that that call. Let's bring in – actually, let's talk for a sec before we bring in any more calls just about this campaign to deport people, Nick. You know, the promise in the Trump campaign was mass deportations. Like, that was one of the things that Donald Trump campaigned on. Mostly, I think people imagined it would be undocumented immigrants. Is that proving to be something that the evidence suggests is actually happening? Or are there other groups that the Trump administration is targeting trying to reach, his goals around people leaving the country?
I mean, they're doing an all of the above strategy here, and that is to get people who are, you know, more recent arrivals. It is to get people, who are here illegally. It is also to expand the pool of people who have, who lack legal status. And by that, I mean, taking away temporary protected status, parole status, other types of people who are here in some kind of provisional, with some kind of provisional legal status or a pending claim. And so they are, they're expanding the pool of deportation, eligible individuals, essentially, all of which is kind of at the service of getting to the highest numbers that they can reach and to fulfilling the president's pledges to deport millions of people, to carry out the largest mass deportation campaign ever. And, the White House kind of more practically setting a goal of 1 million deportations a year, which they continue to fall short of, given, how challenging logistically that is.
Hmm. Meanwhile, at the same time, earlier this year, President Trump suspended refugee admissions except for white Afrikaners from South Africa. That was back in May. What did you make of that, Karen Misawa?
Well, we've talked about what is animating the Trump administration's policies on this, and we've talked about Stephen Miller. And I think, the sort of elephant in the room is talking about white supremacy. And this is an effort that's targeted, for the most part, people of color. And to suspend, on day one, the Trump administration suspended all refugee admissions. And as you said, the only exception that was made was to allow in white South Africans as a persecuted group. And any human rights documentation, objective, credible human rights documentation, will demonstrate that white South Africans are not a persecuted group. And if we pair that up with, every year the administration sets refugee admissions numbers and priorities for the following year, and the Trump administration recently announced that in the coming fiscal year, the only refugees that it prioritizes is, again, white South Africans. So, and it has slashed the number, of refugees to admit. But I think we cannot ignore the role in which racism, deeply rooted racism, plays in these in these immigration policies of this administration.
Yeah. We're talking about those policies with Karen Musalo, UC Law, San Francisco, The Atlantic's Nick Miroff, and Joseph Azam from the Afghan American Foundation. We'll be back with more right after the break. Coming up in the next hour of Forum with Mina Kim, the clock is ticking on healthcare. With federal subsidies set to expire at the end of the month, 22 million Americans could soon see their healthcare premiums more than double. Senate Republicans are floating plans to redirect funds into health savings accounts or dismantle the marketplace entirely. Meanwhile, Democrats are pushing to extend the tax credits. The White House remains unpredictable. We'll look at the proposals and how the vote could shape the 2026 midterms. Hey, you know how you could listen to any past Forum show? Go to Apple Podcasts, go to Stitcher, wherever you listen to podcasts, and find us there. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking about our country's immigration policies in light of President Trump's decision to freeze asylum applications indefinitely. We're joined by Joseph Azam, board chair of the African American Foundation. We've got Nick Miroff, who covers immigration for The Atlantic. And we've got Karen Musallo, who's professor of law and director of the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies at UC Law San Francisco. I want to bring in Noah in Oakland. Welcome.
Thanks. I have a rather disturbing interpretation of this tweet that we're referring to. Without going into too much detail, I have some experience in trying to understand and evaluate white supremacist movements in the United States. There are 14 words in the first sentence of the tweet, and there are 88 characters. This is a reference to the 14 words, which is a white supremacist slogan about securing a future for the white race and the existence of white children. And 88 is a reference to the eighth letter of the alphabet twice, HH, for Heil Hitler. Now, they'll tell you this is a coincidence. But anyone who knows statistics knows that, yes, randomly, you might tweet a tweet with 14 words and 88 characters. But among all the other evidence, among the specific word remigration, which was coined by neo-Nazi movements, this is unequivocal. This is not, it's a dog whistle, but it's pretty loud.
No, I appreciate that perspective. I mean, Nick, I wanted to come to you on this. I mean, earlier you were saying, you know, that reverse migration or remigration didn't necessarily, you know, it was a kind of distinction without a difference. I'm thinking about this rhetoric in several different ways, though, right? I mean, there's the policy that it suggests, but there's also the messages, both, you know, hypothetically at least coded messages to white supremacist followers, to maybe followers in general who know far-right European politics and know what remigration means and how it does have a specific lineage that's different than reverse migration. How do you even begin to report on something like that or come to understand? I mean, you know, there also were all these group chats that came up recently with so many, you know, in a young Republican group with lots of Nazi jokes and things like that.
I mean, I think at this point, these views are inside, you know, they're inside the government. They are irrefutably, you know, in. They're manifesting themselves. We have dog whistles inside of dog whistles. And, you know, I think, you know, I'm not surprised that the tone and the direction and the messaging that has come out of, for example, you know, the social media accounts of the Department of Homeland Security in the last couple months is just, you know, every day there's sort of something you shake your head at and can't believe is real. And these kinds of signals and cues, whether it's, you know, imagery of, you know, of kind of all, an all white lost America or, you know, flat out statements about, you know, saving culture. You see that, you know, the echoes of, you know, the far right campaigns from Europe from some of the darkest episodes in, you know, in the 20th century. And it's just something we've never seen before from the government.
I mean, you mentioned the DHS, social media campaigns. I was not aware of this, but, you know, in our pre-interviews for the show, you were talking about them, that DHS is actually running a campaign of something like go home for the holidays and stay there. Like what's that campaign?
Well, that's part of a more than $200 million advertising campaign that DHS has had running all year to to try to encourage people to self-deport, as they call it, using a government app called CBP Home. And they're offering people free airfare and a $1,000 bonus if they will, you know, definitively just give up and leave the United States. What we reported this week in The Atlantic is that so far only about 35,000 people have accepted that offer, which works out to about $7,500, you know, per person that the government is spending to try to get people to go. And so what we've seen in the last couple of weeks is kind of a holiday-themed advertising blitz from DHS. They make these kind of flippant, glib ads, you know, with Christmas music or black and white imagery of, you know, of America in the 1950s, really to just, you know, and these are ads in English that, and, you know, the target audience is really the president's supporters, who are thrilled, you know, by this kind of, seeing this kind of thing online. But this is what they're spending very heavily on right now.
Karen, this one's for you. Daniel writes, you know, pathos and empathy for asylum applicants is critical. But that aside, what about the cost? Many asylum seekers end up wards of the state relying on government or public benefits. Given that the federal debt's over $30 trillion, many states and municipalities are under significant financial stress. Shouldn't cost and budgeting also play a role?
Well, I really appreciate that question. And I think this indicates some of the false some of the misinformation that's out there, because, as I said, every economic study that has been done has shown that the net benefit to society, economic benefit, way outweighs anything that immigrants receive in return. And so much so that when the U.S. was coming out of the inflation, out of, you know, COVID, Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell said that one of the reasons that the U.S. came out of its sort of economic slump and inflation went down as much as it did compared to other countries was because of the contributions of immigrant workers. So I think, again, that we need to sort of question assumptions that are made about immigrants who are in our society. And if I could just sort of continue on that theme for one moment to say, you know, the other narrative that we haven't really addressed is that of criminality. When the Trump administration, when Trump, you know, promised mass deportation, he put it within this context of we're doing this because we're deporting the worst of the worst. We're deporting criminals. And again, if you look at the individuals who have been arrested, detained, and deported, you know, more than 75% of them have no criminal convictions whatsoever. And those who do have convictions, it's only a very small minority of them that have anything that's a violent or felony conviction. So I think when we have this discussion about immigration, we have to not only reflect on what the policies are right now, but how we got to these policies. And what are the beliefs that are sustaining and perpetuating these policies? And we may then be able to, you know, change public attitude through public education about who really are these people that we're talking about as being a blight on our society. And might the opposite actually be true, that they are contributing in multiple ways that just we're not seeing and we're not being told about?
I mean, to say nothing of the ethical responsibility that the United States bears for having intervened in many of these countries. Like, there are American troops in Somalia. There are American troops in Afghanistan, other, you know, groups in Central America. There are American troops that, you know, that's that part of it also. I think, you know, our listeners tend to call attention to these historical components of which populations have ended up in the U.S. and why. But rarely do you see it in the rhetoric of the president. Let's bring in Sheila in Fremont.
Yeah, hi. There's a regional, there's a saying in my regional part of India called this, wherever there is human being, there's poop, right? So wherever community you think about from, whichever country, there will be bad people and good people. Why single out people from a particular country or community? The question I have for the law professor is, why can't there be laws to curtail the power of the president? And why should the future of America be in a single person's hand? And not with our law communities, people from senators and Congress. That's the question I have.
Yeah. So, Sheila, thank you so much.
Well, I think that's a really good question that's raised, which is, if I understand it correctly, why does the president have so much authority to do what he's been doing? And that is really the reason that there are so many legal challenges that have been brought against the Trump administration's policies, which many of us, myself included, believe are unlawful, that really make a mockery of the sense of rule of law. You know, and just kind of circling back to where we began with one of your earliest questions, Alexis, that our laws provide the right to for people to seek asylum and provide a pathway to obtain refugee status by being admitted, you know, from outside the U.S. and entering as refugees. And the president should not be able to invoke, you know, sort of false justifications, you know, security risk, criminality, and uproot, you know, what our law has provided for and what our international obligations commit us to doing, and which, as you said, and I think so, you know, profoundly, what our ethical and moral obligations are.
Yeah. You know, I wanted to bring to Joseph, you know, the San Francisco Bay Area Office of the Council on American Islamic Relations sent out a statement. And I wanted to run a couple of the things by you. This was a statement by managing attorney David Tarr, and just get your perspective on what this has looked like from the inside. Tarr said, over the past week, our office has seen a clear uptick in calls from Afghan community members who suddenly face new threats to their status and safety. Today, I accompanied an Afghan evacuee to what ICE represented as a scheduled check-in in San Jose. Despite his full cooperation, he was detained on the spot. We're hearing from green card holders who have lived here lawfully for years, from refugees who have already passed extensive vetting, and from families who have been waiting sometimes for years to reunite with loved ones now trapped in processing limbo. This sounds like it is a full-on emergency in the Afghan community here in the Bay Area.
Yeah, absolutely. Not just in the Bay Area, I would say across America, on both coasts and in the heartland. I mean, for the last almost, you know, 5 years, I think our community has really struggled to do what it can to support family and friends in Afghanistan, working arm in arm with veterans and faith groups in the U.S., and to see all of that work now crumble, and the effect of that crumbling be potentially people losing their lives, and having families torn apart. I mean, that's absolutely an emergency. And it's one that, unfortunately, given all the other trauma that this community has had, we're not very well equipped to handle. Right? Because, I mean, on top of everything else, we're Americans, right? We're living in this economy, in this political climate, and in this moment in the country as well. So I would say it's absolutely an emergency, most acutely for the people who don't have legal status, but also for the many people who have been helping them.
Listener Carl writes, people don't seem to realize how many women are assaulted on their way to the southern border or even after crossing. Trump was right in 2015. The southern border had to be redeemed from lawlessness. ICE actions in the U.S. have done a lot to fix it. Nick Miroff, I mean, you report directly on ICE and also on CPB. What do you think about that statement by Carl?
Well, a couple points. You know, border crossings, illegal border crossings reached a record under President Biden. The system hit a breaking point. The Biden administration began to put restrictions in place during the last, during his last year in office that cut, you know, illegal crossings dramatically. But by then, you know, it was already sort of too late for Biden politically. And since Trump has gotten in, the measures that he has taken, the deployment of the military, the ban on various forms of humanitarian processing along the border have really driven things down even further. I don't attribute it so much as, you know, to the interior ICE campaign as to the broader perception that the border itself is closed, that the pathways that people use to cross and then try to get released into the United States, all of those are closed, and that's why we see illegal crossings along the border now at their lowest level since the 1960s. So far fewer people are coming in. That has proved to be, generally popular, I think, for the president. But the attention has really shifted to the administration's interior campaign led by ICE that is focused on deporting as many people as possible. And so the attention has really shifted away from the border.
You know, one interesting piece you're reporting too, though, right, is that there's CBP and there's also ICE, and that they actually have traditionally used pretty different tactics too. Yeah.
Oh yeah, that's right. as we described recently in the Atlantic, the Border Patrol is being deployed by this administration in a way that we've never seen, and that is, first in Los Angeles and Chicago, Charlotte, now in New Orleans, you see Border Patrol Commander Gregory Bovino leading agents around the city doing using tactics that are more akin to kind of roundups or sweeps. That is different from the way ICE agents are trained. ICE, in part, to defend its role in U.S. law enforcement, has always insisted that it engages in targeted enforcement, that ICE officers know who they're looking for when they go out. ICE is obviously under a tremendous amount of pressure. The administration has been unhappy with ICE's ability to get, the kind of mass, huge numbers that Trump and Stephen Miller want, and that's why we're seeing the Border Patrol being brought in to play a more and more aggressive role and to become really kind of take the lead in advancing the White House's objectives here and getting as many people as possible.
Joseph Azam, I wanted you to spin it forward. I mean, you were on the show back in May and had some guarded optimism, I guess I would put it, about what might happen for Afghan refugees and, people who were American allies in Afghanistan still. Where are you now?
If Afghans know one thing, is that if we let go of hope, we have much of nothing left. So, I still think it's possible for this administration to course correct because of how popular its effort and the previous administration's efforts to help Afghans were. So I still think it's possible, but I think what we're doing right now is really traumatizing people and creating more issues potentially for the U.S. Than we would have had if we just focused on the mission that started with evacuating and resettling Afghans. Mm-hmm. So, Alexis, I have to be optimistic, because if we're not optimistic, then, we can't get the work done.
Mm-hmm. Karen, how about you on the legal front? What do you expect or think might happen? You mentioned earlier that you sort of have some expectation that some of these policies will be stopped in the courts.
So I do think that, so many of the policies contravene the law and they will be stopped. But I think perhaps equally important is the fact that as Americans see what is actually happening and see the brutality and the injustice, they see their neighbors being dragged away. They see people who they consider members of their community deported. What I'm hoping is that public opinion will change, because what we need, to advance is not just victories in the court, but we need the public to look at these policies for what they are, which is destructive of our society and inhumane and cruel and very costly and providing no real benefit to Americans. And, as was said earlier, immigrants are being scapegoated to cover up the failure of this administration to deal with the real needs of American people. And so I hope that people will see that and place that pressure points will not be on, immigrants, but on getting the administration to come forward with what it promised people in terms of the economy and other things that it said it would deliver.
Yeah. We have been talking about our country's immigration policies and in particular the effects on the Afghan American community, which we know is, strong, thriving community here in the Bay Area. We've been joined by Joseph Azam, board chair of the Afghan American Foundation. That's a nonpartisan nonprofit focused on advocating on behalf of the Afghan American community. Thanks for joining us, Joseph.
Thank you.
You can also follow Nick Miroff's reporting in The Atlantic. He's a staff writer covering immigration, Department of Homeland Security, and the U.S.-Mexico border. Thanks so much for joining us, Nick.
Thanks, Alexis. Same time.
And Karen Musallo, who is professor of law and director of the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies at UC Law San Francisco. Thank you so much for joining us, Karen.
Thank you so much for having me.
Appreciated your insights. And thank you to all of our listeners, our callers, and our commenters. We really appreciate it, as always. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum Ahead.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the Generosity Foundation
and the members of KQED.
Guy Marzorati is the guest host for the next hour of Forum. They're going to talk about the negotiations over Affordable Care Act subsidies on Capitol Hill and how the issue of health care could shape the 2026 midterms. The next hour of Forum starts after your traffic update, including trouble now in Hercules. Here's Joe Salvatore.
Yeah, Michelle, this is a big problem on eastbound 80 before Highway 4. All lanes right now are blocked. This is all due to a multi-vehicle crash. I was already out there, then another car came and hit one of these vehicles. So now all lanes are blocked. Traffic is backed up to Appian Way. Palo Alto, southbound 101 before Oregon Expressway. It's a two-car crash that's over in the right lane. Joe Salvatore for KQED.
KQED's newsletter, One Good Thing, helps you rediscover the Bay Area you call home with local recs and uplifting reflections.